Welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and I had a cloaking device way before it was
cool. Was it called being a nerd?
Yes, it was. No one noticed me.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and like Saru, my desperate search for peace and harmony has left me forever altered, or maybe just my voice. I'm sick. That's a joke about how I'm sick, everybody.
It sounds like you've been breathing in too much weird ethereal blue pollen. Well, together we run a speakeasy in the Jeffries Tubes.
Today we're talking about the 8th episode, Si Vis Pacem, Para Bellum.
The episode was written by Kirsten Beyer, who is a wildly popular Star Trek Voyager novelist. And when she was added, when it was announced that she was going to be added to the writing staff of Discovery, I think the shout of exultation from collective fandom, I think, was heard around the galaxy.
Yeah, that's amazing. They've really brought some good veterans, shall we say, writers and directors on. I know we're going to be getting a Jonathan Frakes episode soon, right?
Yeah, can't wait for that.
And it was directed by John S. Scott. And Glenn, this is our, I believe, third week in a row with a classical reference as an episode title. Aren't we lucky?
We are. It's actually been kind of amusing to me, Valerie, to re-listen to our own episodes and discover that despite the fact that you and I both have degrees in classics, we have not been talking about these classical allusions much at all. But given that today's episode title is in Latin and you and I met in Latin class, I feel like we ought to talk about it a little bit.
I think we always aspire to talk about it, and we do what we always do. We say we're going to talk about that later, and then we get wrapped up in, you know, space whales and we forget about things like the River of Forgetting. So this episode title is Latin for if you want peace, prepare for war. And Glenn, it actually comes from an author that lands right in my gap of knowledge, but squarely in yours.
Yeah, Valerie, this comes from a military manual by a Roman writer named Vegetius, who has kind of a manual or kind of a handbook of, you know, how to run the Roman army and how to use a Roman legion to fight battles. And this is a phrase that he uses when he is describing the Roman training routine, the Roman training regimen.
I mean, I knew that our skills of close reading and critical thinking might apply to our ability to analyze these episodes, but I could have never guessed that my training as a classicist and Renaissance literary scholar and your training as a Roman military historian would be at all relevant to this podcast.
See, I always knew it. I always knew it. Well, on that note, Valerie, should we dig into the plot recap here?
Yes, please. Let's get going.
So this is our second week in a row, Valerie, with no teaser, where we just go straight to the opening title sequence. And we open here with what I found to be an exhilarating spaceship battle. The USS Gagarin, NCC 1309, is under attack by 6 Klingon vessels. And this is the first time, Valerie, that we've seen a USS Gagarin on screen. But there was a USS Yuri Gagarin that was listed on a computer screen in the very famous and very excellent TNG episode, The Measure of a Man.
Oh, interesting.
And of course, Gagarin here is, Yuri Gagarin is the famous cosmonaut, the famous Soviet astronaut who was the first human being in space.
It's good to see that they're really keeping up with naming their ships appropriately, as we've discussed before on the podcast. That's awesome.
And we're going to have a couple more names here before this episode is out. In fact, I wanted to talk kind of immediately about another name. We see Captain Tishen Kovil, he's the captain of the Gagarin. We see him sending out a distress call. And this name, Tishen Kovil, really intrigued me. And I don't know, I want to know what you'll make of this, Valerie. Tishen, to me, sounds like a Vulcan name, though this person is clearly a human. And Kovil is a name that might be Tamil, the South Indian Dravidian language. It's certainly a Tamil word that refers to a type of temple. And I don't know what you make of that.
Yeah, Glenn, this is a really interesting question. He's already up on Memory Alpha as a human male. And it would be really fascinating if they, although a little bit contradictory to the main character of our series, if they're trying to imply that there's some other part Vulcan, part humans out there that we don't know about, because there only being two, Burnham and Spock, is pretty central to the plot. But it could be an indication that names from other planets become fashionable on Earth. I mean, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. I mean, I think we're given to understand through, I don't know, a veritable host of context clues, especially in Enterprise, that Vulcan culture is really important for the development of the Federation, and that in many ways the Federation is, or at least the humans that we see in TOS and TNG, are a human culture that have been deeply, profoundly influenced by Vulcans. This is sort of where the Prime Directive comes from. This is where our fleeting flirtation with veganism in the early seasons of The Next Generation comes from, for example. You know, we learn in Enterprise even that the designation of habitable planets, M-class planets, comes from a Vulcan word. So I think that would certainly be in keeping with that. And I would like to read this name as being a nod to that, though I'm also interested in alternative theories that listeners might have.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's really not a big leap, one, to think that, you know, people might be named after major cultural figures in general. But people are naming their kids after, you know, characters in Disney movies in 2017. So I like to imagine a future society where, not that I don't, you know, enjoy Moana very much, where we're naming people after cultures that represent our ideals, or our new ideals, our better utopian future ideals.
Like to imagine, I think, taking my cue from you, Valerie, that maybe Tashen's just a real popular character on a Vulcan soap opera that Koval's dad really loved watching.
Oh my gosh, that would be so much better. I'm switching camps. Yeah. I'm going for your theory now.
Well, I might write up a bit of fan fiction this weekend, but I think for now we can leave Captain Koval's name at least behind to get to the real action of the scene by announcing Discovery's sudden appearance out of nowhere in answer to Captain Koval's distress call. And Valerie, before we get into the specifics of the battle, I just want to talk about the bridge crew interaction in Discovery here, or at least on the Discovery bridge. And I loved that Captain Lorca is aggressively standing right up on his view screen rather than sitting in his chair. And I also really loved that he's barking orders at his crew and that they're kind of like snapping back with I, Captain, in unison. This really appealed to me. I thought it was very exciting.
Yeah, I can see why. Yeah. You know, it's a very interesting contrast to what we normally see captains do, which is lounge back in the chair kind of apprehensively while they wait for more information, and usually only get out of their chair or up from behind their desk cautiously to approach someone on the view screen, like somebody that they're having a conference call with on the view screen that they need to respectfully stand up for. But they're usually not assertive or aggressive in their posture. And that's definitely in keeping with Lorca's character to have him doing that.
Yeah, I thought it was just some great physical acting, or some great physical direction to really tell us, to show us really how Captain Lorca does differ so much from these other captains. Even Kirk, who commands with quite a bit of swagger, does so from his chair.
Totally. And I really enjoyed just visually as well how they're making use of how the bridge is basically just a big glass window. A big long glass window to give us shots from the outside of the ship looking in. And I think at the end of this battle scene, we're outside the ship looking into the bridge through that glass, and we see Lorca turn away and walk back to his chair once it's all over. And I thought it was a very powerful and effective shot.
Let's get to the actual battle now that you've alluded to its completion. So the details of the fight are this. The Gagarin cannot warp, and so the only way out of this situation is for Discovery and the damaged Gagarin to team up and defeat the Klingons. And this is going to be a real tough task. For one, the Discovery can't target the Klingon ships when they have their invisibility screens up. And Valerie, I really thought that this information was delivered in a way that explained, you know, what's going on, explained how cloaking devices work to newbies, while still also not just sort of keeping the interest of Trek veterans, but I think even in some ways raising the stakes of this battle for Trek veterans.
Yeah, and it also ties in, I mean, this scene is a prelude to the problem that's going to be the main part of the episode, which is figuring out how to see where Klingon ships are, right? That's why this scene is here, is it sets up what we're going to have later or provides the background information for it in a lot of ways. So they did it in a way that was not heavy-handed.
Yeah, not at all. This was really fantastic exposition. It was great writing. On my second watch, I think I just paused and kind of slow clapped a little bit.
I'm sure you did.
So as the battle continues and the Gagarin simply cannot take anymore, Lorca orders Discovery to get between the Gagarin and the Klingons in order to intercept a pair of torpedoes. And here, Kayla looks worried, even as she's carrying out the order. And I thought that she really sold, well, me at least, on the high stakes of this move. We can see that Kayla is actually worried about whether or not Discovery can take these impacts. And I was worried, too.
It's definitely a pretty cool move. It was very fun to watch. And it really conveyed the drama of the scene. And I think, as you said, the stakes of the scene in a human way that you wouldn't necessarily get just by looking, you know, at two spaceships in space battling it out. They kept bringing us back to the humanity and the human effect of all of these kind of wartime battle decisions. And to follow up on the bridge dynamics, I don't know if you're picking up on this, Glenn, but I feel like the rapport is, while it's more assertive and aggressive, I feel like the crewmen on the bridge are also more assertive in speaking back to Lorca. Not that they like talk back to him or act out, but they tell him the truth, even when it's that they can't get it done or something's not going to work or they're afraid or whatever it is. And they're not hesitant to shout that back at him. Have you noticed this as well?
I did. And this is something that really not just appealed to me as what I said earlier, and maybe that's not quite right, but it rang true to me that this to me seemed like a well-functioning system, or even a well-functioning machine, if you want to take that metaphor, that, you know, part of Lorca's style of command is to demand candor from everyone that he interacts with, everyone on his crew. And that seems like the type of CO I would have liked to have served under. I did serve under COs like that, I should add. But that's the type of unit that I would want to be in. That's the type of ship I would want to serve on.
It seems though it's a very delicate balance to be under Lorca's command, though, because while he seems to want that candor, he also, there's a fine line between candor and too much for him, because the hierarchy is really important. And I can never quite tell when he's going to appreciate that someone steps out of line or when he's going to be real mad that someone steps out of line.
Yeah. And I think that if you're someone who really thrives in an environment with clear rules that are always obeyed, this might not be the command for you, but it would definitely be the command for me.
You talking about me? I didn't score 100% on rule following on the Kobayashi Maru, Glenn. So there's some wiggle room there for me too.
Yeah, about 8%, as I recall.
Okay, all right, let's move on.
All right, well, in the end, Discovery is only able to intercept one of these torpedoes, and the other one hits the Gagarin and destroys it. And now, with the Gagarin gone, there is no more need for the Discovery to be here. And so they prepare to spore jump to safety. And holy torpedoes, Valerie. I thought this battle was absolutely intense, which I know is a word I've already used about it. But I was really, like, I was holding my breath, really, for the entire duration of this scene. Like, from the moment that we come out of the opening title sequence in up until this moment, I don't think I breathed at all. I was just kind of enthralled by it and also scared the whole time.
I think it was a little bit less impactful for me, which, you know, might be because I am less able to imagine myself in that situation than you are. So it has less personal resonance. My general feeling with a lot of things that happened on Discovery and with this battle scene in particular is that they happen so quickly. These scenes are over so quickly and moved on from so quickly that sometimes it doesn't allow me to sit with their impact. And maybe that's an intentional thing, because the next line that we get from Lorca is, there's going to be time to grieve, but the time is not now. We don't have time for that now. And so the pace of that might be intended to give me that feeling. But I think it's different than what you're experiencing while viewing.
I am also experiencing that as well. And in fact, I think that's something that I have noticed about this show that differs so much from especially TNG is simply the number of scenes and therefore the brevity of those scenes. And I think you're right to point to one of the consequences of that being not enough time to kind of breathe or soak things in. That's definitely a tonal shift here in Discovery.
It's not a show for slow consideration while you're watching it. It gives you a lot to go back and find on a rewatch or to let your brain mull over and realize happened a couple days later, which is fun on its own. But, you know, I think in a lot of ways this is shaped just by what the pace of editing and action has become nowadays compared to, you know, even now we watch TNG, it feels so slow, but and you watch TOS and it's, you know, when I first started watching it, I was like, how am I even going to get through this? I'm so bored. And that's because I'm used to a much faster pace of editing. But as I've kind of fallen in love with older shows, I find this quick movement more unsettling rather than comforting.
Yeah, and there's something that's actually done in Discovery in general, but especially I noticed it in this episode, which is that they cut scenes up, that scenes end kind of in the middle so that each scene always has something of a small cliffhanger ending before it cuts to another scene, even though we know that we are going to jump back and complete whatever's going on. This episode did this maybe a little bit too much, actually, for my taste. It was a real hallmark of this episode.
So do you find that disorienting, or do you find that it keeps you on the edge of your seat? And do you have an opinion about which one of those two things, if either, the show creators are going for?
I suspect that the show creators are going for keeping you on the edge of your seat. I do find it more disorienting. There were a couple of specific places, actually, where I would have liked, to have just had the scenes be a little bit longer rather than jumping around. Well, let's get on to our next scene then, where we head down to engineering to see Stamets and Tilly getting ready to spore jump. And here we see, Valerie, that even though I went on for a long time last week about how cool the thing on Stamets' arm is because it isn't a jack,
it's totally a jack.
I still thought it was cool, but I was way wrong.
It wasn't a jack last time. It was flat last time.
Yeah, I thought it was too. Okay, so I'm not insane. I didn't go back and check, but I'm glad that you're making me feel better about myself. You know, it's all getting jumbled in my mind as I continue to eat mushrooms. So I'm glad you're validating my objective sense of reality here.
Yeah, no, I don't really know, I mean, how they're going to explain this huge plot hole of how his implant goes from flat to not flat. But this isn't going to be the last of it you hear from me. But really the main point here is this is the first time I think since we originally saw Stamets step into the spore drive that we see him in it again, right?
Yes, that is right. It was cool to see how the technology has changed, that he is not passing out and cackling anymore. Though we're going to see in a couple of scenes that there are still consequences, and perhaps even more serious consequences.
Yeah, the Stamets stuff in this episode left me really confused. And from the scene, I have to say, he looks super high while he's in there, as we kind of pointed out last time. And it's very strange to me that nobody else seems to have a problem with it. Because he doesn't look like he's okay.
No, he doesn't. And I think we're going to find out in this episode that he is not. And I'm excited to talk about those points when we get there. Following on to this, Valerie, we get this line of dialogue that you already brought up, where Lorca tells the bridge crew that there will be time to grieve for the Gagarin, but not right now. And, you know, this brings to mind that we've still never gotten a funeral for Landry. It's just something that we don't get as an audience. And we don't even know really if Discovery itself ever actually had any kind of service, any kind of ceremony, any kind of ritual way of dealing with the loss of their own crew member. And I think we're going to see some contrast. Again, you and I have already noted some contrast in the way that Klingons, or certainly T'Kuvma's Klingons and humans, are dealing with death, and especially with dead bodies, with corpses. And we're going to see that again in this episode. And I thought it was interesting to see that kind of emphasized here.
I think we're meant to move past deaths of people that we liked and thought were going to stick around really quickly. And I would like to give the show the benefit of the doubt that this is supposed to say something about the realities of war, but honestly, it just feels gimmicky. It's just shock value. And I really don't appreciate it.
I think I do have more faith in the writers about this than you do. I do think that they are up to something. But maybe that's something that we can save as a topic for our mid-season wrap-up episode. We can kind of catalog all of the evidence and kind of sift through it and see what we come up with. All right, well, we get back to engineering now. We're going to pick up with the Stamets storyline, where Stamets gets out of the spore drive and he is very confused and he wonders what Captain Tilly is doing in engineering. And I wonder, really, what did you infer from this? From this, I don't know, slip up, insistence that Tilly is the captain?
A whole lot. So in order to answer this question, we have to get a little bit ahead of ourselves to the scene, which we'll discuss more, I'm sure, in a bit, where Tilly confronts Stamets and is like, what's up with you? This is weird. And Stamets gives an explanation that involves him saying, you know, I get things mixed up, like I see different realities or something like that. I forget the exact line. So I was definitely wondering if he sees into different points in time, if perhaps what he's seeing isn't, I forgot you're not captain, but you're going to be captain one day, and something about being able to travel all across the universe also allows me like some sort of glimpse into different points in time. And an acknowledgement that she will be captain one day.
We know from last week that Stamets is not existing, or he is existing outside of normal space-time. So I think this is probably the best thing to infer from this. And maybe we are going to get that Captain Tilly show after all someday.
I will say, I would love to know if you agree or disagree. I did not take from it that Tilly will be captain on the Discovery, or that Tilly will be captain during the time that we spend with her while we're watching this show. I inferred that Tilly will eventually be captain somewhere in the Star Trek universe that we're probably not going to see. That's what I got. What about you?
You're right that we are not going to see Captain Tilly as captain of the Discovery here in like the second season or something like that, because there are, you know, literally like 80 officers ahead of her in the chain of command. But it is interesting to note, though, that Stamets knows this not as some kind of omniscient observer. He knows this because he seems to be, or at least I inferred that he seems to be able to see different points in his own timeline. So I think we can infer that at some point he will be serving under a Captain Tilly, or at least that he has seen a future where such a thing happens.
Oh, that's really interesting. So this means also potentially, if all these things we're guessing come to pass, that Stamets stays in Starfleet.
Yeah, that's right. And well, presumably, you know, he and Dr. Culber are continuing to get the same assignments.
Yeah, I guess if it's a way to stay close to your man, you got to do it.
Well, let's carry on with this scene. Stamets realizes his mistake and he covers for it by returning to form as Jerk Stamets once again. I think I missed him. I'm not sure.
I'm so confused. So this part of Stamets has been completely absent, and the fact that he's completely absent has been our only way to understanding some certain questionable decisions that he's made in the last couple episodes. And all of a sudden he's back? He's not living in a mirror? What's going on?
I don't know. I was surprised by this. I thought that we were on the slow train to the mirror universe, or slow train to some riff on The Enemy Within, but that no longer seems to be certain. I will say that if that mirror scene comes to nothing, I will be disappointed, maybe a little heartbroken. That's probably going to be like a one whole box of Kleenex for me.
I really liked where they were going with this, and again, you know, I'll try to give them the benefit of the doubt like you are, or more credit. But you know what, let's pick this back up when we get to the Tilly Stamets scene that happens in the mess hall. How about that? And you take us to our actual next scene before we get stuck.
Sounds good. So in our next scene, Lorca is on the holophone with the Vulcan Admiral T'Rall, and we learn here that the Gagarin had been traveling with two other ships, but that they were destroyed before Discovery got there. And here's where I want to talk about names some more, Valerie. The first of these ships is the USS Hoover, and I just want to know, who do you think this ship is named for, the USS Hoover?
Yeah, my first guess would be President Hoover.
You know, I thought that too. And then, of course, there's J. Edgar Hoover, the infamous director of the FBI. But I actually think it's probably the test pilot, Bob Hoover. He was a real famous and real daring test pilot. He was actually Chuck Yeager's kind of, best friend or kind of runner-up. If Yeager had been sick on the day that he was going to break the sound barrier, Hoover would have been the person who flew in his place.
Well, that seems much more likely.
We've already seen that there have been ships named after test pilots. The Jaeger was a ship at the Battle of the Binaries. And even really right here, the USS Gagarin was a test pilot who, happened also to go into space, right, and as a cosmonaut. But I also, when I was thinking about this, I realized that Bob Hoover actually died just as Discovery was entering production. And so I thought this was a real nice way to honor someone who was a participant in our early experiments with jet engines, which were so important for our own ability to get into outer space.
Yeah, that is really awesome. I'm just not well-versed enough in my Hoovers, but that sounds like a much more likely and much sweeter explanation.
So let's take a look at the second of these ships. This is the USS Muroc. So I'll just have to say, Valerie, that I didn't know about this one. When I first watched the episode, I always watch without the subtitles on. And so when I heard the name, I thought it was a Vulcan name. But then when I saw it with the subtitles on, it is spelled with a C, not a K. So I don't think it's Vulcan. And so I'm at a total loss.
I wonder if it's not spelled correctly in the subtitles. Because that happened with the USS Sioux in the pilot, and it was in the subtitles, it was spelled S-U-E, but it was clearly S-I-O-U-X. It was meant to be S-I-O-U-X. So maybe there's a misspelling?
Oh, you know what? I think I've got to believe that that's what's going on. So I think that's going in my head canon. This is a Vulcan ship. We don't know who or what Muroc actually is, but maybe that'll get fleshed out for us in some subsequent series to begin airing around 2035 or so. So there's something else that we learned here in this scene, Valerie, though we've been able to infer it already, and that is this. General Cole, the Klingon General Cole, has reverse-engineered Takuvma's cloaking device on the coffin ship and is equipping the vessels of his vassals with them. And there are two things I want to talk about here, and maybe let's start with the Klingon institutional stuff that I like so much. And then I think we need to have a very serious and very frank talk about cloaking devices.
Okay. I'm nervous, but I'll give it a go.
I think that it is really awesome here that T'Rall uses the word fealty to describe the relationship that Cole has with other Klingons. And this is, to me at least, explicitly feudal language, and it provides a nice glimpse, I think anyway, of how the Klingon Empire functions as a, or really the emperorship within the Klingon society, Klingon political institutions, sort of functions as a de jure institution with no de facto power. And so the way that I'm reading this, Valerie, and you can tell me if you think I'm insane here, is that the Klingons have gone from being space Soviets in the original series to being space samurai in the TNG era. And they now appear to be, I don't know, space Carolingians or space Capetians or maybe even space Ottonians. And as an early medieval historian, I think that this is super cool. Really, I think it's super awesome, and it really appeals to me. But I don't know if you're reading this word choice that way.
No, I definitely noticed it. Although I think that it would probably help our listeners because I think a lot of people are familiar with Soviets and samurai, but probably less so with the three words you just mentioned. So, can you briefly sum them up?
Yes. Well, I'll sum up one of them. I will talk about the Carolingians here because I do think that's probably the closest analog. The Carolingians are a ruling dynasty in medieval Europe in the 8th and the 9th centuries. They are named after a guy named Charles Martel. In Latin, Charles is written out as Carol, and so his descendants are called Carolingians. Martel means the hammer, so he was Charles the Hammer, which is a really awesome name that I just wish weren't already taken. And his most famous descendant is the Emperor Charlemagne, which is Charles the Great in French, who very famously becomes the emperor, sometimes called the Holy Roman Emperor, on Christmas Day in the year 800. He is crowned by the Pope. And when his grandsons in the 9th century get to fighting amongst themselves about who gets to be the boss, who gets to be the highest ruling king, or perhaps even who gets to be the emperor, in fact, not perhaps, definitely who gets to be the emperor, this political situation contributes to a situation in which local rulers are able to exert their own authority and pay less and less attention to who is the king or who is the emperor. And this is a big contributing factor to the high medieval political system that is often called feudalism. And it's a system in which there is nominally someone who is in charge, or at least there is a supreme office to whom or to which everyone owes loyalty and some kind of obedience, right? Someone who is actually the highest military authority, the highest legal and judicial authority in the land. But de facto, nobody paid any attention to that because there wasn't anyone powerful enough to actually exert any control or any authority or power over people who had claimed those things for themselves in their own corners of Europe. And this just seems to me to be what's going on with the Klingon Empire here, that there are 24 very powerful political families and lots of other political families of less power who seem to have maybe a varying state of alliances with one another to have more control over resources and people, to marshal forces, to defeat enemies, to conquer new territories. And they all still think that they are in something called the Klingon Empire, but there is no emperor, and they don't actually want any one person to be in control of it.
Thank you, Glenn. That was extremely informative. And you're right to point out that, you know, you've used a lot of other key words here. You made a very good vassal pun earlier that I let slide by. Fealty definitely is the swearing of an oath, of an obligation to a feudal lord. And it's telling that that's how we refer to, I guess, what we would call the Klingon nobility in this show, is with the title lord.
That's right. So all of this really super excited me, and I'm looking forward to kind of being able to talk maybe even at greater length about this when we are able to have a wrap-up episode, when we think back about the entirety of this sort of first half of season one of Discovery. But I think, Valerie, it's probably time for you and I to have the talk.
Oh, I had so many more questions I wanted to ask you about why you thought there was this shift to Carolingian Klingons. I guess we'll have to save that for a longer discussion. But I think it's worth also just pointing out here as well that within this system that you've just outlined, there are very clear like social hierarchies of power that are also very apparent within the Klingon society that we're seeing on Discovery. Though I will ask, what happened to the whole maybe Klingons are space Egyptians thing that we were thinking from the pilot?
Yes. Well, I think we will get to that actually in this episode. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay. Glenn, let's have the talk. When a Klingon warbird and not being caught love each other very much, what happens?
Right. Discovery, I think it's fair to say that Discovery is changing everything that we thought we knew about cloaking devices. And maybe I'll just run down a little bit of what I'm thinking here. So traditionally, cloaking devices or invisibility shields, as we hear them sometimes called, these were the special purview of the Romulan Star Empire, which has not featured in Discovery at all, though I assume we will see some Romulans. Well, actually, I assume we probably won't see some Romulans, but that's for another time. The first time we see this in Star Trek is in the TOS episode Balance of Terror, which is it's one of my absolute favorites. I have a poster for that episode hanging in my apartment. And it's not until the TOS movie, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, that we have Klingon ships with cloaking devices actually appear on screen. And the reason this happens has to do actually with production stuff, sort of meta or extra textual knowledge, right? So the early drafts of the script of Star Trek III actually had Romulans playing the role of the villains in that film, and that's why their ships have cloaking devices, why they cloak and they decloak. They were changed kind of at the last minute to be Klingons for a variety of reasons, but none of their accoutrements were changed in the script. And so the introduction of Klingons with cloaking devices, you know, is really actually kind of a production accident or a production oversight here.
That's fascinating. What were the factors that led to the change? Do you know?
Leonard Nimoy, who of course played Spock, was instrumental in that decision. He thought that the Klingons were more menacing than Romulans, and I think that that's true. And since the script calls for a lot of hand-to-hand fighting, I think that was the real thing that pushed them into the direction of Klingons rather than Romulans.
That's a really good point, because I cannot picture Romulans in hand-to-hand combat. It just seems beneath them, right? They would use their smarts and not their brawn to fight their battles. So Leonard Nimoy is actually responsible for a lot of other aspects of the Star Trek universe that we now regard as canonical, particularly with regard to Vulcans, that weren't originally written into scripts. So it's interesting to see that he played a hand in this as well.
And this choice that he makes here in Star Trek III gets validated in the Next Generation era, which begins just 2 or 3 years later, when Klingon ships all have cloaking devices. And so we just accept it kind of at that point. And in Deep Space Nine, one of the spinoffs of The Next Generation, there is even some retconning, some retroactive continuity applied to this phenomenon, this issue of Klingons having cloaking devices. And this comes in the episode, it's a 7th season episode called Once More Unto the Breach, one of Star Trek's many borrowings from or allusions to Henry V. And this is another really great episode. And in it, we learn that Klingons used the new technology of cloaking devices at the Battle of Kaleb 4, and that this would have been in the late 2260s, which is to say right at the close of the original series, which is why we never actually see it on screen in the 1960s, but why we do see it on screen in the 1980s. And this seems to be confirming something from the animated series, which ran after the original series, but which only recently became canon alongside all of the live-action shows. And in the episode The Time Trap, there's some dialogue that indicates that Klingon ships have cloaking devices, but we don't actually see that on the screen. It's just something that two people on the bridge say to each other, and it's almost even kind of a throwaway line. And so Discovery is the only show that's been made since the animated series was declared canonical, which I think is something that happened about 10 years ago. And so there have been a lot of fan theories that have often surmised that the Klingons got the cloaking devices from the Romulans as part of their, I don't know, Byzantine scheming, using their brains rather than their brawn, as you just put it, Valerie. And that might still be true, but seeing all this happening here in Discovery kind of 15 years earlier than anyone previously thought, to my mind at least, seems to be changing all of that, not necessarily contradicting it, but changing it.
Okay, a couple of things here. The first thing is that I do wonder, kind of in the same way as a lot of people are saying, well, the spore drive's effects on Stamets are going to be what ultimately leads to it not being developed as a travel technology. That's why we don't see it in future series, because it's decommissioned. I wonder if the result of the war here is that all Klingons with knowledge of cloaking devices are a fall in battle. There aren't any of them left. Or if, as part of the peace treaties, they have to destroy the technology and they just spend a great deal of time between the end of Discovery and just after TOS trying to figure out how to do it again. That could be one potential explanation.
That's a real good explanation, and it actually would in some ways kind of be a nice parallel that we are seeing these two powers, these two foes, each toying with new technology in order to fight a war with each other, and the war ultimately actually takes this technology from them.
Right, and it's new technology that is not universally shared among their peoples, right? Discovery is still the only ship with spore drive and more and more each episode, more and more each day, but not all Klingons have this technology, only those that swear loyalty to Lord Cole. But my second question is, I was led to believe from the pilot that T'Kuvma invented this technology. Were you?
So that's a great point, Valerie. I had this question while it was going on. And so I actually, although I don't have it in front of me now, I had gone and looked at the language that is used there. And there's nothing that Tukuvma ever says that indicates that he is claiming to have invented it. He is claiming and is very proud of the fact that he is the only Klingon to have this technology, but he doesn't claim to have invented it. And so I have been surmising the whole time, really inferring the whole time, that he is the one who got this from the Romulans, that he actually has some special relationship with the Romulans that I had been thinking was something that was going to come into play in Discovery at some point, that was going to undermine, even before he died in the second part of the premiere, I was thinking this is going to be something that comes up later that will undermine his authority. Even then, when Tukuvma died, I thought, at some point we will see Voke or Laurel or somebody carrying on Tukuvma's mantle, and this connection, this with Romulans, with someone who is not, some with people who are not Klingons, is going to taint their own Klingon purity and call into question their legitimacy. Now, it doesn't seem likely that that's going to happen now, but I still maintain that probably Tukuvma got this from Romulans, not that he invented it.
That would be an interesting alternate theory to why they stop using the cloaking device, is that they find out that it had a non-Klingon source and that makes them not want to use it. That would be, I think, unusual, because I'm assuming they're going to want to do whatever gives them the advantage in battle, but...
It is an interesting conundrum here to be having to deal with, and it would be interesting to see the Klingon culture having to wrestle with that problem. And I will say that we haven't gone over all of the evidence. There are more ancillary issues that will further complicate this question. And I'd be real interested in hearing listeners' own theories or own explanations for what's happening here with cloaking devices.
Glenn, this is all fascinating and really catches us up about what's going on here and how important and new and confusing this technology is, both probably to other Klingons and to the Federation, which is actually why the Federation is going to try really hard to do something about that, which leads us, I hope, to our next scene.
Yes, Lorca and the Admiral are still talking, and here the Admiral tells us really what the stakes are now with these cloaking devices, and it is this: if the Federation doesn't win the war before all the Klingon ships can cloak, or if the Federation can't find a way to see through the Klingon cloaking devices, they are going to lose the war. They will not be able to defeat the Klingons. And so Discovery's mission right now on the planet Pavo is Starfleet's highest priority. And we are going to move directly into our next scene to the planet Pavo, where we open with Burnham's personal log, where she sets the stage for us. She says, "Every object on the planet vibrates with its own specific tone, which combined to form a kind of music, the signature sound of the planet." I thought this was a really cool concept to have in the show, and I thought this was kind of a beautiful bit of prose. I love Burnham's logs. I know you don't, Valerie, but this really touched me.
Yeah, I was thinking, I have to say, if I may lower the tone a bit, which I think I always do, is that I'm pretty impressed people are still coming up with new unique planets, new weird things that planets have on them, because we've done a lot of them in the Star Trek canon.
Yeah, and this one was really cool in its visual appearance as well. I couldn't find where they filmed this, but it was absolutely gorgeous. I want to go there, even though I know that the leaves won't actually be blue. That was some CGI, but it looked really cool having this blue forest. It was awesome.
Yeah, you're right, Glenn. It was a gorgeous effect, and I thought they did a really good job of not overdoing it. The blue kind of fades into a dark green on a lot of the trees, so it doesn't look like a hyper unrealistic forest, or, a forest that's just been covered in bright blue food coloring. Which reminds me of a time that leaves were covered in bright blue food coloring, or something akin to it, in the original series. This is a really iconic scene because Spock smiles in it in response to these plants, which is very unusual for his character, as we all know. It first appears in the pilot with Christopher Pike as captain, The Cage, and then reappears in an episode later on in the season that kind of goes back into that narrative called The Menagerie, Part 1. It was a two-part episode. So we see this scene twice, and those plants, they're kind of like weird wires with blue leaves on the end. Certainly not a forest the way we see them on Pavo. They're on a planet called Talus 4, and they're called the Talosian singing plant. They vibrate and make music, and that's what makes Spock so uncharacteristically happy to see them. And here we see that the blue planet, whether it's the leaves or the sparkly life form question mark, really changes Saru's character as well. So that, I wonder really if they meant to help us see that connection.
I'm sure they did, because there is actually another connection between the plant life, or really all the life on this planet, and yet another original series episode. But I'll wait to bring that up until we actually get to the scene where I want to draw that connection. But I do think that the writers are having a good time with making these connections and are inviting us to see them and sort of share in their joy at sort of making these homages to the original series.
Okay. All right. So we're on the planet, and now what?
Right. So there is a landing party from Discovery on the planet that is made up of Burnham, Saru, and Tyler. And they are here for a towering crystal structure, a sort of naturally occurring transmitter that the Federation believes can be modified into a type of sonar that will be able to detect cloaked ships. And they have had to beam down 30 kilometers away from the transmitter. And this distance that they have to traverse gives us an opportunity to learn some things about Kelpians. The first thing we learn is that they can run really fast and they can run really far. They can reach as much as 80 kilometers per hour. And Saru says that he could actually run this whole 30-kilometer distance in one go in about 15 minutes, and that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, jealous.
And they also, Kelpians, have senses that are far more acute than those of humans, and therefore the sounds on this planet are torturing Saru.
As someone who suffers from migraines, I really, really sympathize with this. It's not fun when you have heightened sensory awareness.
And I think the actor does a wonderful job of selling his agony to us as we go.
Yes, he really does. He's fantastic in this role.
At this point, we get some blue ethereal pollen mist stuff that descends from the forest canopy. And Saru thinks that this might be a sentient life form, and so he tries to initiate contact. And it wants them, or seems to want them, to go somewhere that is in the opposite direction of the transmitter. Well, we go next to the coffin ship, where Laurel has just arrived, ostensibly to join Cole's army. She's freshly minted, I guess, with the scar that she got from fighting Lorca. And when she's talking to Cole, Cole compares himself to T'Kuvma in a way that, again, I found really fascinating. He says that T'Kuvma wanted Klingon unity, which is to say that T'Kuvma wanted a new Klingon nationalism that would do away with the old feudal order. But Cole merely wants to sit atop the current Klingon system without changing anything inherent about that system, that he's looking for supremacy under his rule, not to change the Klingons or to make them better. And we get this contrast here in sort of seeing T'Kuvma as someone who really cared about Klingon society, Klingon culture, and Cole is in this for himself.
And that's much more in line. You know, they really set up, you know, T'Kuvma's ship was a ship of misfits, right? Cole is the more traditional Klingon here. That's what we would expect from a Klingon character.
And we're going to see here some tension continuing between these two groups. But what we see right now is that Laurel wants to prove her utility to Cole by using her super cool House Mokai skills as an interrogator to get Admiral Cornwell to talk. But we need to pause that until we get the completion of this scene. And for now, we go back to Pavo, where the blue pollen is leading our heroes to a tent in the woods, where it engulfs Saru's arm and communicates with him through, I don't know, some sort of telepathy, I guess.
I gotta say, I did not think about this until right now. How did they build a tent?
Right. I wondered this as well, because it's not just like some of it looks like it's just kind of growth, plant growth. But no, there's like a linen, there's cloth, like there's something that people made.
Like that is not a naturally occurring tent.
Right. And so I'm perfectly willing to just say that we have to ignore that detail. But I don't think that we do need to, because I think right. The effects in this show are so great that they could have done away with that. They didn't need to do it that way. So I almost wonder if we're supposed to notice it and ask that question, but I don't have an answer to it.
I don't know. I think the simplest explanation, and therefore probably the most likely one, is that they didn't think about it. They just wanted to be in a cool, sparkly tent, or maybe even, I don't know, that the landing party, the away team, found this cool crystal fireplace and put a tent around it. Or maybe, as you said, you know, we learned at the end of the episode that Paavo is perhaps not what it seems. So it's anyone's guess at this point.
Well, the real heart of this scene, or the real point of this scene, is that they now know that the Paavins are sentient. And Burnham explains that now that they know that this blue pollen stuff is a sentient creature, they cannot touch the transmitter without the express and informed consent of the people who live on this planet. And we get a great explanation here too, Valerie, about the difference between the Prime Directive and First Contact protocols that I think is nice probably for Trek newbies, but frankly was nice to hear as a Trek veteran as well, because I think this can all get kind of confused and muddled.
I find the Prime Directive / General Order number one very confusing, because they're never really explaining it and they're always breaking it. And I thought that this was actually a very clever way that to me did not seem like they were just trying to create a plot point, but that is in fact what they were doing, of explaining how we violated the Prime Directive by interfering with a pre-warp civilization. Oh, but we didn't know there was any life form here, so not our fault. I guess just we'll keep going. Which is more than we get usually for the other times Star Trek crews break the Prime Directive. So I appreciated it. I did. I also appreciated the explanation.
Yeah, and this is going to create some dramatic tension here when we return to this scene, but I guess I should get used to saying it here in this episode. For now, we're going to get back to a different scene. We're going to pick up back in the coffin ship where Laurel is ready to interrogate Admiral Cornwell. She brandishes a blade and tells Cornwell to scream. Cornwell, however, won't do it. So Laurel gets in her face and screams, and Cornwell gives it right back, you know, like baring her teeth and just screaming in Laurel's face. And I have to say, Valerie, I was hooked by this. I was, at this point, really second-guessing my decision to smooch Admiral Cornwell rather than marry her a few episodes ago.
You could hear it in the way you just described that. It was a weird thing to describe romantically, Glenn, but you did it.
But the point of all of this screaming is that Laurel is not really going to torture Admiral Cornwell, that she just wanted to get the guard to go away. She wanted the guard to believe that there was torture happening. But we're going to have to wait a few scenes before we actually find out what's going on here. And for now, we return again to the planet Paavo, where Tyler and Burnham are talking while Saru is trying to communicate with the Blue Pollen. And we learn here that Tyler has post-war plans. He wants to go trout fishing on Lake Shasta in California. But Burnham can't have any post-war plans because no matter what happens, she still has a life sentence for mutiny. And Tyler now suggests that maybe they should just leave the transmitter alone so that they won't be able to use it to win the war, and therefore Burnham can continue to remain on Discovery. And then he kisses her, and Valerie, I have to say that I really hated this moment, and but I'm wondering how you felt about it.
I mean, it was a romantic moment. Of course I hated it. I'm suspicious of Tyler, and I can't... It's interesting, because you would think that Burnham wouldn't really be in a kissing mood after somebody said something so disloyal to Starfleet, right? I don't know. Whatever, there is blue sparkly stuff. Things happen. I do want to add one thing, which is that I did find Burnham's articulation of what I'm sure she always knew to be true, but even I hadn't really thought about, and I'm sure her fellow crewmen hadn't thought too much about either at this point, now that she's really part of the family, which is that she's not fighting for her own future. I found it pretty moving for her to point this out. I felt her pain and sadness in this thought of struggling with everything that she's gained and the fact that she's going to lose it again. So I did like that in this scene, I will say.
And we're going to see in a couple scenes, actually, a little bit more about how Tyler is feeling about his own service and about the war. And I'll be interested to hear what you think about that when we get there. But for now, I think we should move on to our next scene in the Discovery galley, where Tilly is confronting Stamets about his spore problem. It's a scene we've already talked about a little bit. But I want to point out here that just this great line that Tilly has, where she comments that Stamets has returned to his persnickety, grumpy self. And this is just a hilarious line. As always, Tilly makes me smile and makes me feel good about being alive.
Yeah, it's great. You're right. Tilly makes everything better.
But Stamets dismisses her. I mean, no, doesn't mean like he ignores her. He actually tells her she's dismissed and that she should go away. But she stands her ground and she forces him to talk to her. And this is where he explains that his mental world is getting jumbled. But really kind of the emotional core of this scene is when he's talking about Dr. Culber, because he can't tell Dr. Culber what's going on with him, because that will put the doctor, who is also his partner, in an impossible position.
So why can't he just tell another doctor?
That's a good question. And presumably because he also doesn't really want to actually go get poked and prodded by Starfleet doctors. And it is possible that he has now bought into how important he and Discovery and the Spore Drive are to the war effort at this point.
I suppose. I think that you're right. The crux of the argument here was supposed to be a compelling romantic one, of not wanting to put his partner in that position and also not wanting to have to separate from his partner. You know, they're serving together now. And if he was shipped off to some science facility to be studied, that would be quite different. Probably be a while before they see each other. And I can understand also Stamets being distrustful of the institution and what they might do to him. What I don't understand is that Tilly accepts this narrative, because I understand why Stamets is thinking this way, but it is not a compelling reason to continue hurting himself the way he is from an outside perspective.
Right. Tilly agrees to keep Stamets's secret and to help him monitor these episodes. And this is not a good idea. If they get caught, if something goes wrong and she was aware that this all was a problem and that can be demonstrated, she will be in a lot of trouble.
Well, it's also interesting because he says he doesn't want to put his partner in that position, but he kind of puts Tilly in that position by sharing this. So it has the same effect. It's just the consequences are less personally deeply felt by Stamets in the end if something does go wrong. But I think we can chalk that up to he's emotional until he asked, and, you know, maybe he shouldn't have said anything, but he did. I just find it surprising that Tilly doesn't go tell someone. Though, one, you know, maybe she just wants to be nice and she really thinks it's the right thing to do and she wants to have friends. But also, maybe she knows that it's worse for everyone for Stamets to go away. Maybe she also understands that this is just the reality, is that this has to keep happening to him for the sake of the greater good. This is her way of walking kind of the fine line between those two positions.
Right. And so I don't think we quite finished up earlier, Valerie, having our conversation about what is going on with Stamets' personality and the mirror Stamets. So what do you think is happening here?
I don't know. I feel like every week we kind of are forced to do this or like guess at it. And if they eventually give us an answer to all the questions we're asking, then this is fun. If they don't, this is maddening as an exercise to have to do while watching the show. So only time will tell. But since I'm used to guessing now, if I had to guess, maybe sometimes Stamets is in the mirror and then sometimes he's not. It's not very good.
But it seems to fit the evidence right now. But I'm with you, Valerie. If we don't actually get some explicit acknowledgement of that shot, I will be disappointed. Yeah, I will definitely be disappointed.
So we're not going to solve this right now. Where do we go next?
Well, we get back to the coffin ship, where we learn that Laurel wants to defect to the Federation. You see, General Cole, Lord Cole, has taken everything from her by disbanding Takuvma's cult. Even Volk has been chased away, which I find to be a suitably vague phrase, Valerie.
Very vague. Definitely suspicious.
Yes, think we're going to see... We have not seen the last of Voke, I think that we know. But for now, Laurel has a plan, which is that she will get herself and Admiral Cornwell to her own ship, but then it will be up to Admiral Cornwell to get them onto hers. And Cornwell balks at this because, you know, she doesn't have a ship. But Laurel says that she means Discovery. And at this moment, of course, I thought that this was all a ploy for Laurel to get on Discovery and to do what Harry Mudd could not, which is deliver the ship to the Klingons.
I'm going to save my commentary. I'm going to save my reading of the scene until it comes to a head a little bit later. But I think we need to be also equally vague here for a moment, Glenn, and acknowledge that we are aware of the existence of the internet theory that explains where Vok is. But we don't want to talk about it on air in case it becomes a spoiler. So we're not talking about it on purpose. And if you don't know what we're talking about it, don't spoil it for yourself. Don't go look it up. Just come along with us on the ride.
And for now, I think we can ride into the next scene, Valerie, perhaps my lamest transition of all time, but I'm going to stick with it. We are back on the planet Pavo. Saru is telling us that he is slowly learning to communicate with the Blue Pollen people, and that he has learned that the life forms on Pavo are a collective life form of sorts, and that they live in peace and harmony together. Moreover, they desperately want to know others, and to be known by them, hence the transmitter. That night, the planet is just so loud for Saru that he begs the planet to be quiet, even just for a minute. And the Blue Pollen does a sort of mind-meld thing with him and learns about Kelpians, about the war and their mission, and about Saru's constant state of fear. And when the meld is over, Saru seems to be at peace. And the next morning, he's refreshed. He's gotten a good night's sleep. The noise isn't bothering him anymore. But he lies to Burnham and Tyler, and then he destroys their communicators.
This is where we learn that Kelpians are also super strong. He totally just crushes those things.
Yeah, I mean, like empty beer cans. In fact, even better. I mean, they like disintegrate.
Yeah, like, I mean, Kelpians, what can't they do?
They run fast. They crush communicators like Quint. Yeah, I mean, they're pretty terrifying. In fact, we're going to see some pretty terrifying physicality from Saru here in a few scenes. But right now, Saru is explaining to Burnham and Tyler that the Blue Pollen has invited them to stay and to live in eternal peace and harmony. And Saru has accepted that invitation on their behalf. This is all very, very creepy, Valerie. And it reminded me here, this is where I will bring in this other TOS episode I mentioned earlier, reminded me of that classic episode, This Side of Paradise, where a strange flower is able to mind control the Enterprise crew.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that's such a fun episode. People also love that one because Spock smiles in it because he's so out of character. He's been taken over by the spores of this plant that he's joyful and youthful and giddy and doesn't follow orders. And It you know, to much delight to the audience to see him out of character there. Yeah, that's a really great comparison. And I did want to say real quickly, I meant to mention it in the beginning, that I was just super excited in general to get an away team episode and a new planet episode because we haven't had one of those yet on Discovery. And it's actually, you know, the plot of the very first Star Trek episode, The Man Trap, where they, you know, they beam down to another planet and encounter a weird creature. So this is very much part of what it is to be Star Trek. And I was excited to see them exploring it here. And of course, it always goes, they go to a planet and something goes wrong. So here's what's going wrong. I have some questions for you, Glenn, about Saru's change of character here, but I think they're better served being asked at the end of the episode.
Well, let's carry on with this scene here then. Saru leaves Burnham and Tyler so he can continue talking with the Blue Pollen, and the pair of them begin to plan an escape. Tyler wants to use the transmitter, but Burnham is worried about following procedures, something that is clearly intensified in her character following her mutiny and her receiving a life sentence for that action.
You also kind of see that interestingly in how quickly and without thought they hand over their communicators.
He tells them a story, but I just feel like I wouldn't want to give that up if I were on that planet, knowing that's the only way to get off the planet. I would have asked for more details, which is not insubordinate. It's perfectly within, not just perfectly within your right. I mean, it's almost an expectation. You as a subordinate need to understand what the mission parameters are in order to fully be able to carry them out, and certainly to be able to adapt, you know, to things that might change. So they should have asked. I certainly would have.
Yeah, and I guess I just thought it was a little unusual, but explaining it through the lens of Burnham does what she's told now is a pretty good explanation. Anyway, I interrupted you.
This is where Tyler and Burnham get to have a little conversation about their different viewpoints here about First Contact and about the war. Tyler says that Saru seems to actually have gotten the consent of the Blue Pollen, and anyway, this is the only way that they're going to be able to win the war. And besides all of that, he's in charge, so he gets to decide. But I was really annoyed by this, Valerie, because literally the night before, Tyler was suggesting that maybe they shouldn't use the transmitter so that he and Burnham can be together so long as the war is raging. But if this here is what he really means, then all of that, everything he told Burnham, was just to get her to consent to some romance. And that's really gross.
I don't know. I'm gonna, as a person who often thinks that people are gross, I'm going to disagree. I think you're reading way too much into this. He said a cute thing. I think we can really land on he didn't really mean we shouldn't try to win a war so that we can be together. He was just, being cute. He didn't mean it.
People do communicate in that way, but usually they say it, I don't know, with a smile and with a different tone of voice. And I just didn't see that in the scene. I thought Tyler was speaking the exact same way that he does when he's having serious conversations. So I took him seriously there, but probably I totally misread it. And I would like to have misread it. I would like him to not be gross. I would like the show to not be showing me something like that as well. So I will happily accept your reading.
Good.
Well, with that matter put to bed, I think satisfactorily, we can get to our next scene where we are on the coffin ship. Laurel and Cornwell are making their escape. But first, Laurel wants to set the warp engine to blow so that Cole will be killed. But they're discovered. They get caught. And so Laurel and Cornwell pretend to be fighting, or at least that's how I read it at this moment. But while they're fighting, or really even before they get started fighting, Laurel tells Cornwell that at least she won't die in a cage. And then she holds her up to some kind of electrical thing, and Cornwell appears to die. And Laurel now tells Cole that she'll dispose of the body. And I have to say, Valerie, at this point, I thought Cornwell was pretending to be dead so that they could continue their escape. But that's not true.
I held on to that hope to the bitter end. A little part of me thinks maybe it could still be true, but it seems like she is dead. This scene made me look back on the quote-unquote torture scene between Cornwell and Laurel as Laurel being sincere, especially because we're about to see that Cole doesn't trust her and knows that she's lying. And I think that reinforces for us that Laurel feeling alone and really not wanting to serve this purpose or this war or this leader anymore has some sincerity to it. So I don't know. Did the scene change your opinion of whether or not Laurel was sincere in the torture scene?
There's one more scene that we're going to get with Laurel that really informs my answer to that question. So I think we might profitably table it until we get there. But I do definitely want to discuss what is up with Laurel, what her motives are, what her agenda is, and how we can read these scenes. Because Laurel is not done being important, I don't think.
I certainly don't think so either. So yeah, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here. But can you explain to me why Cornwell had to die or how this serves the plot?
Unfortunately, I think Cornwell is just being used here by the writers to advance Laurel's story. She's being used here to show us that Laurel wants to get off the coffin ship and onto Discovery for whatever reason. And we'll talk more about what her motives are when we get to kind of the end of Laurel's arc in this episode. But with Cornwell dying, that is not now an option for Laurel, and we're going to have to see Laurel adapt. We're going to have to see Laurel make different choices. But this was a way for us to see what her aims are and to have something at stake for her.
And Cornwell had to die for that?
Well, I don't think she had to die, but that is what the writers decided to do, and it does serve that purpose. And make no mistake, I am as upset and disappointed as you are that Cornwell has died.
Yeah, she's such a good character, and I don't like the way that they're killing people off. You know, I've said I don't need to be a broken record about this, but it does serve the plot point of Lorca not wanting Cornwell maybe to come back from this mission, or at least not wanting her to come back for a while. So perhaps seeing how Lorca reacts to the news of her death will give us some insight into what he really meant when he sent her away.
Oh, that's a great observation. Though I wonder when he'll actually find out that she's dead. It might be in the next episode, as we will find out here at the end of this one. Should we move on to our next scene and draw closer to that end?
Yes, please.
All right. Well, we are back on Pavo, where Saru is looking for Burnham and Tyler, but he only finds Tyler here in the tent. And Tyler says that he and Burnham had a fight, but we know that that's not what's going on at all. And Tyler tries to keep Saru in the tent by asking him to explain what's going on with the Pavians. And Saru is happy to explain. And he says that they took away his fear. And of course, Valerie, this reminded me then of Spock's brother, Sybok, taking away everyone's pain in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. But for now, we should carry on with the scene here. And Tyler continues to try to keep Saru occupied by telling him all of his feelings. He doesn't just want to defeat the Klingons. He wants to hurt them. He wants to make them suffer, even if that turns him into a monster. Saru hears this, and he wants to heal Tyler. He wants to give him the same peace that he's found here on this planet. So he goes over to the edge of the tent, and he gets a weird glowy green rock thing and does some sort of mind meld with Tyler. I didn't really quite understand what was going on here, but I'll buy into it.
Here we're seeing our first kind of psychological consequences of being held captive on Tyler that are playing out in kind of the way he feels like he doesn't have things under control and doesn't fit in with the crew because he is in conflict with what he knows he's supposed to want. And what he really, like the vengeance that he truly wants. Or maybe something else is going on there.
Yeah, well, in their mind meld, Saru discovers that Tyler's intentions are false. And I wanted to ask you here, Valerie, that given your suspicion and skepticism of and about Tyler, did you read this as a double entendre for us, the audience?
I 100% did. And I almost thought that this was going to be the moment where we find out everything, the truth about Tyler, but it doesn't seem to be. But oh, yeah, I saw that.
Right. What is actually happening here, the single entendre of this line, is that Saru has discovered that Tyler is just trying to distract him from finding Burnham, who is off trying to help their escape. And as a result, Saru chokes Tyler until he tells him where Burnham is. And this was terrifying to watch.
It was really intense. Saru is scary.
And we switch next, Valerie, to a very quick scene of Burnham at the transmitter, where she's plugging in Federation technology and trying to contact Discovery. But this scene is very brief. It really just serves to let us know that because Saru has gotten wise to Tyler, that Burnham is in jeopardy. And we get a shot here even of Saru running really fast. And so things do not look good for our hero as we cut out of this scene with some dramatic tension. And we will come back to this in just a moment. Well, for now, we are back on the coffin ship where Laurel is dragging Cornwell to the ship's corpse room, I guess is what this place is. I'm not sure.
I don't think Laurel knows either. And, you know, we see at the end of the episode that she's, or maybe it's this scene, she's horrified by how the bodies are being treated. How the bodies are being treated is consistent with how we might think Klingons would treat bodies. As we mentioned in the first couple of episodes, once a Klingon falls, you know, from what we know of Klingon culture before Discovery, is that the body is simply an empty shell. It's irrelevant. So I guess this treatment of the bodies is in line with other things we know about Klingons. But for the Dukuvman cult, it's horrifying, horrifyingly disrespectful. But I think it is just a body room.
what she discovers here is the bodies of all of her friends from the Tacuvma cult. And so I think that we needed to take her at face value when she was talking to Cornwell and saying that they'd been disbanded, that they'd been scattered, that she didn't know they were dead. And it's in this moment that she finds out. But I'm really glad that you want to emphasize in this scene that it's not just that she's finding out that her friends are dead, but it's the treatment of their bodies, or the disrespect of their bodies by Cole is something that is offensive to her religion and therefore must have been horrifying to her.
So I do think that Laurel was being sincere in her offer to Cornwell. But to your point that we should take it at face value that they have been disbanded, wasn't it the case that they all defected to Cole and Laurel and Vok were the only ones that didn't?
Yes, that's right. And so, but I do think that this is the moment. She doesn't know they're dead until this moment. So I think she was just assuming that Cole had, you know, had his way with them, that he had gotten what he wanted from them and then disbanded them because for a variety of reasons. Yeah.
Okay, so you think that Cole murdered them after he got what he wanted, which was the cloaking technology and a bit more of a following. I was reading it as they just died in battle. You know, this is a room full of many Klingons who died in battle, and a couple of them happened to be from Tacuvma's cult. Your reading makes more sense. I understand. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, because she gets real mad here, and she swears an oath that she will avenge them. And I felt like that was going to be that use of the word vengeance there had to be about murder and not just about the treatment of their bodies, though I do definitely think that she is angry about that as well. On this note then, Valerie, of how we're meant to read these other Laurel scenes, and in particular, how we are meant to understand what she tells Cornwell, I'm still uncertain how sincere she was about wanting to defect, but I absolutely believe that she hates Cole and that she wants to get off the ship and that she wants to get on Discovery. I don't know that she really wants to like just go live in the Federation and maybe give the Federation some information that will help them win. I think she wanted to capture Discovery and use it for her own purposes against Cole.
I'm going to alter that slightly. You're right. I don't take her at face value that she wants to live among the Federation. I think it's at face value that she would rather be a prisoner of the Federation than continue living the way she's living. And to that end, I don't really read in this episode that she is trying to do something tricky with the Discovery. I really just read that she needs to go somewhere, you know, and that's why she asks Cornwall about how prisoners of war are treated by the Federation. And she just would be much happier to go sit in a cell.
Right. And I just read all of that as an attempt to win Cornwell's confidence and to play on Cornwell's sympathies, to play on Cornwell's emotions.
Maybe she's playing on my emotions. Either way, I mean, I found it effective, but we'll find out soon enough, I hope.
We might not, because the plan is not able to be put into place here. So I would invite listeners to write in, come to the forums and let us know what they thought. And on that note, Valerie, I have to say, right, that of course, this is where I finally admitted that Cornwell is dead. And I didn't want her to be dead. I wanted her to keep being a character on this show. I feel sad that I didn't get a chance to invent a cocktail for her. That's something I might just do on my own time off the show, because I think she deserves it.
Yeah, well, Glenn, I don't know. This show seems to kill characters, so she's probably dead. But, you know, if Discovery is picking up on different themes from popular shows in recent years, maybe she's not dead. Maybe the next episode starts with her eyes opening, because the last shot really is a top-down shot of her lying there. I half expected her eyes to open. Maybe that'll be how the next episode starts.
It is possible she is just unconscious from this electric shock. And I think when we get to Laurel's final scene here, we might bring this up again, because I think there might actually be a way to see that that's definitely going on in Laurel's actions in that scene. But for now, I think we need to move again very quickly, as we talked about at the top of the show. We need to move to our next scene, back on the planet Pavo. So now the transmitter is ready, and Burnham just gets off a message to Discovery before Saru arrives and really smashes up her computer. The two of them fight, and then they talk.
Yeah, Glenn, I wanted to just say one small visual thing about the fighting that I found really striking. And this is similar to in the episode where they're on the USS Glenn. And I noted that there was that foot stuck in the door. And then we get these really scary visual shots of the crew running. And we see just their feet, which was a nice visual tie throughout the episode. The way that Saru drags Burnham by one leg across the dirt in this fight scene is exactly the same way that Laurel drags Cornwell by one foot around the ship and into the body room. So seeing Saru do that exact thing to Burnham's body after just having seen Laurel do it to Cornwell's was very powerful for me.
Oh, that's a great observation. That was totally lost on me. I simply did not notice it, but I will look for that when I watch this episode again.
It really made Saru and his intentions much more menacing to me in that scene. But that was just a small detail that stuck out to me. So after their epic fight, what next?
Yeah, well, I mean, the fight might very well go on if the blue pollen does not magically appear with Tyler, sort of as a kind of teleportation thing to break up the fight. And here at this point, Saru begs the pollen to help him stop Burnham, but Burnham begs the pollen to help her end the war. And the Pavans silently decide to help the Federation, at least that's what it seems, because they get the transmitter going and Discovery receives a message and then beams the landing party back to the ship.
And the crystals look real cool.
They do. I thought this all looked very awesome. It was a real cool transmitter. I loved this planet. I definitely want to go on vacation there.
Maybe not. We'll wait to see.
Yeah, that's true. I do think I like the way it looks, but I might not want to actually get the full Saru treatment. Well, at any rate, our next scene is in the Discovery sick bay, where Burnham wants to tell Saru that what happened on the planet is all right. That, you know, she knows he was under the influence of something and that he wasn't in control of himself. But nonetheless, Saru is despondent. He says that Kelpians are born afraid, and they never know a moment without fear. But on Pavo, he did, and he didn't want that feeling to end. And this is not a feeling that I have, I think, ever really had, Valerie, but I really enjoyed this scene for the fact that it gave me pause and made me think about and made me try to have some empathy with someone who is afraid of everything. And that was helpful for me.
It must be a really torturous state of mind to be in, especially when that fear isn't really serving you anymore. In fact, it's in conflict with the other things that you're trying to do. I'm getting a little bit tired of hearing statements that start with "we Kelpians," and then, you know, a new fact about Kelpians. I think they could maybe start writing it a little bit differently because it feels like I've heard it before. But my major question with this scene is Saru saying that he wasn't altered by the pollen? He, in fact, just wanted to experience peace so badly that was full Saru? Like, Saru is really responsible for all of his actions there?
I guess the reading that I had, Valerie, the assumptions that I made was that the pollen, when it mind melds with him or whatever it does to his mind, is not making a permanent change, but is making a temporary change that is only going to be in effect so long as he is either on the planet or in contact somehow with the pollen. And that now that he's back on Discovery, either or both of those circumstances are no longer possible. And he has kind of broken that connection, that he's kind of come down from a drug.
I read it differently. I mean, maybe that he came down from a drug, but that drug is the feeling of peace. And that it was actually him wanting to cling desperately to it that made him act that way. That's how I read this scene.
Yeah, you have a much more sinister reading of Saru's actions than I do. And I'll be interested to see where the show goes with that. Your reading is simply not one that occurred to me.
I guess, I mean, it had sinister results, but I don't think he meant it in a sinister way. I think he really meant, hey, guys, we can just live happily here. Like, it was really powerful to him. And I viewed this scene as him very somberly, with a lot of regret, explaining why he did what he did.
I might be able to read it that way if all he had done was smash up equipment. But he chokes the heck out of Tyler, and he beats the heck out of Burnham. And I feel like I have to understand, have to infer that he was under the influence of something, that he wasn't in full control of his normal faculties.
I guess I just, I thought it was more of his, like, for lack of a better term, like primitive Kelpian instincts kicking in.
I mean, you could very well be right about that. And I will be interested to see if we get anything more on this. And of course, I would love to hear what listeners have to say about how they read this scene.
Glenn, okay, so let's get off of Paavo and go back to the Ship of the Dead.
Right. Now Laurel reports to Cole, and she tries to save herself by pretending to have extracted some useful information from Admiral Cornwell. But Laurel here, at least to my reading, Valerie, still seems to be playing a game as she tries to use Cole's derision of her as an opportunity to leave his service and to leave the ship. And that's how I read what was going on there. But now that we've been talking, Valerie, I'm actually wondering if it might really be possible that Admiral Cornwell is alive in that corpse room and that Laurel is intending to go back and get the unconscious Admiral Cornwell here at this moment.
I honestly don't know what's going on. I will say that I read this scene as Laurel being desperate, having no other options, and pledging her service to Cole and Cole seeing through it. That's how it all felt to me. She is a smart cookie. So you're probably right that there's more going on. What that more is, I honestly don't know right now. She's delivering a very good performance, which is consistent with her spy work. So we'll see.
Yeah, I do think she was intending to use this as an opportunity to get off the ship. And I'm going to choose to also now sort of see your hope here in this scene as well. And I am going to believe that Admiral Cornwell is not dead, at least for another week. I'm going to believe that Admiral Cornwell is alive. She is merely unconscious in that corpse room. I don't know what will become of her since Laurel cannot get off the ship, as we'll narrate here in a moment. But I'm going to hold out hope.
Well, I have less hope, but I'll let you cling to yours.
All right. Well, at this moment, Cole stops Laurel from leaving the ship, and he says that he does value her interrogation skills, and he welcomes her to his cause. And he smears his house's red paint on her face to sort of admit her to his house. This must be part of the fealty ceremony. But he does this in a way that, to me, seemed designed to humiliate her. It seemed violent and seemed almost like a violation of her.
I think that's a correct reading.
Well, when he's done doing this to her face, Cole says that he knows that she is just trying to deceive him. And at this moment, he has her sort of taken into custody and taken away from him. And we don't get a resolution of this. We won't know what's going on with Laurel and perhaps even Admiral Cornwell until next week. But at this moment, the ship receives a massive signal from Paavo, which Cole interprets as an invitation and orders the ship to set course. Well, we're going to go now to the Discovery Bridge, where we're going to have a similar story to tell. The Pavan transmitter isn't doing what they wanted it to do. Instead, it is sending a signal on only two frequencies, Federation and Klingon. Burnham surmises that the Pavans are trying to end the war, and to me, this sounds a lot like the TOS episode Errand of Mercy, in which an alien species forces the Klingons and the Federation to stop fighting.
That brings to mind something I said last week, which is that so I enjoyed this week's episode less than last week's. And part of that is because they're going to a planet. There's an away team. So I thought I was going to get like kind of a self-contained episodic thing. But they're continuing to give us glimpses of that or a feeling of that, but to spread it out over several episodes. So normally we would all, you know, everything would be resolved when we beam away from the planet. But here we see that this planet is going to be part of at least one more episode. So that's an interesting choice that's in keeping with, you know, what they've been doing with the show.
Yeah, and I'll say at this point, Valerie, even though we know we have one episode left before the mid-season break, that the Klingon flagship and our protagonist ship are going to be physically occupying the same space in that episode, I don't know how this is going to get resolved or if it's going to get resolved or what's going to happen next. And I'm excited to find out.
I think we're going to get, you know, true to form for the show, a big cliffhanger for the mid-season finale, right? I mean, that's what this is setting us up for.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But let's get to this episode's cliffhanger right now. The Discovery detects that the coffin ship is en route to their location, and Burnham says that they are the only defense the Povans will have against the Klingons, so they cannot flee. They will have to stay, and they will have to fight. And that is where our episode ends.
So what do you think about that, Glenn?
I find it very unexpected. This is not the direction that I thought the war story was going to go. I thought we were going to have a lot more of Discovery fighting Klingons, maybe kind of at the fringes of the war and making some raids. I didn't really think that we were going to have a showdown between the Klingon leader and the Discovery, certainly not in the middle of the first season.
I never know anymore from one episode to the next. You know, the opening shot of the next episode could be Lorca being like, don't care, and they, you know, spore drive out of there.
I would actually kind of love that.
But I was more wondering what you thought. I gave you a very vague question, so that's on me. What you thought of the rationale that they are now responsible to save the Povans, even if it means losing the Discovery?
That is a great question. I don't know that that's actually, in fact, I think I definitely do know that it is not explicit in General Order Number 1 or the Prime Directive, but that does seem, to me at least, to be in keeping with the spirit of that they now have an obligation to the inhabitants of this planet to protect them from this mess that they've gotten themselves into. Except that I would say that, you know, they did decide to use the transmitter for this purpose. So maybe they don't have a moral obligation to do that. And you know, it does maybe in some ways then seem a little bit like a plot device to get this showdown. And I think that there is not a great chance that your snarky comment about Lorca just saying, nope, don't care, we're leaving, is, I don't think that's real likely to happen, but it could. I wouldn't put it past these writers to do something like that, actually.
That's an interesting response, because you were basically able to dodge my question, which was, you know, if you're stuck between protecting we assume defenseless species that you kind of got into this mess and saving yourself for the sake of the war, what's the decision that you make? But you bring up an interesting point, even if you don't get at that answer, which is a tricky one, so I don't blame you, which is that maybe the Povans have their own responsibility in this, because, you know, Discovery didn't force them to transmit two frequencies.
Yeah, I didn't mean to be dodging your question, Valerie. I just was thinking of it from a writer's perspective, I think, which is how I walk through life, I think. But I don't want to dodge your moral question. We are watching Star Trek so that we can have these moral questions posed to us and try to answer them. And I will say that I don't have an answer that is definite, but my gut feeling is that I think the right thing to do is to stay and fight, and stay to protect the Povans if fighting is necessary in order to do that.
You know, that's interesting, because I kind of thought that you might say, well, yeah, you should, but war. That war is an excuse not to. Just like you had kind of said, you know, you would think that Lorca would be okay to ignore the space whale because war. I feel like because war is an answer to a lot of questions in this universe, and I'm glad that they're allowing us to think about these moral quandaries without throwing immediately at us something to get rid of them, like the excuse of war that Lorca likes to use so much. So kudos to them.
I think it's an interesting conundrum. And I guess I read this scene as completed, as if Lorca had agreed with Burnham's assessment and made the decision to stay. But that's not really what happened. So we might even, I think it's unlikely that we will open with Lorca deciding to get out, but we might open with a discussion of it. And that would be great, I think. I would love to hear that discussion.
Yeah, I would too. So high hopes for the next episode.
But before we get to next week, before we get to the next episode, we have some business left here tonight, Valerie, which is that you have invented a cocktail for this episode and you're going to share it with us. So what do you have?
My first thought was that I had to create something blue and sparkly, harder to do than you would think, while also making a drink that tastes good. So I kind of took a cue from you, Glenn, which is that in your last cocktail, you made it a about the whole episode and the spirit of the episode rather than just one particular character. So I tried to do that, although it's possible that I just made the planet the character. So I was really excited to have a planet-based episode, to have a new planet and a new life form of some sort. So this drink is dedicated to Pavo and the Pavins. It is called Pavin Harmony. And what I really wanted to do was capture the essence of the forest. Because as you had said, you want a vacation there. We all want to go camping there. And it's just such a forest-dense and foliage-dense planet. And it's very visually striking. So that's what I was trying to capture. So contrary to my typical MO, it is a Scotch drink.
Oh, I am very surprised to hear this. Even after sort of listening to you talk about foliage and flora, I'm surprised to hear Scotch. But is this a peaty Scotch that you're going to use then?
No, it is a grassy Scotch. So really what will make this drink amazing is if anyone is able to get their hands on this Icelandic Scotch called Floki. I'm pretty sure you can only buy it in Iceland. My roommate happened to bring some back recently, and it tastes like you're drinking hay. If you want a drink that tastes like the forest, this is that. But I would just say pick a grassy Scotch. I ended up using a Lowland 8-year Scotch whiskey here. And it's 2 ounces of that, 2 ounces of the Scotch of your choice. And then 1 tablespoon of rosemary syrup, which is just simple syrup infused with rosemary. And rosemary is a very powerful herb, so this is going to come through in the cocktail. And then 1 ounce of Zurbenz, which is a pine liqueur from the Alps. So it kind of tastes like you're drinking a pine tree, but in the best way. So 2 ounces of the Scotch, 1 tablespoon of rosemary syrup, and 1 ounce of the Zurbenz. Stirred over ice and serve with a burnt orange peel and a rosemary sprig, Glenn.
Oh, that's going to have several different sort of plant flavors in it. And then I guess even including that orange, that's really going to make some of those pine flavors from the rosemary and the Zurbenz really pop. That sounds delightful. I don't have Icelandic Scotch here, but I have other types of Scotch, and I do have the other components. We grow rosemary in our apartment, and I have some pine liqueur as well. So I might even make one of those before I sign off for the evening.
It would be really great for sipping by the crystal fireplace in the tent made by we don't know who.
Well, now that you have crafted a drink for people to enjoy in a variety of wilderness environments, I think that is going to do it for this episode. But we'll be back next week for the last episode of this half season. And until then, I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. And you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com.
Come on over to the Clay Temple forums and let us know what you thought of this episode. And you can maybe weigh in on the question of whether or not Admiral Cornwell is alive or dead. Optimism will be appreciated, but I'd love to hear your theories.
Or you can tell us who you think made the tent. I can't let it go. But until then, stay spacey.